Ford Canine LLC. Are you looking for a handler school, trainer school, or attend one of our one-week development courses for dogs, handlers, or trainers? Are you in one of the various detection dog scent sports doing nose work or scent work? We have classes and seminars for you as well. We offer trainer classes as well as seminars for many of you handlers. Ford Canine is not just in Vegas, but we can come to you with many of our seminars like Canine Cognition, Detection Using Cognition, The Trust Momentum, and many more. Ford Canine also offers fully trained detection dogs. Contact us. We have access to a variety of breeds of dogs that Cameron custom trains to meet your detection needs. All dogs come with a handler school when you pick up your canine as well. For more information, go visit our website, www.fordcanine.com.
Welcome to Talking Sense, the podcast where we discuss all things detection dogs. Broadcasting from Scent City at the Ford Canine Training Center in Las Vegas, here's your host, Cameron Ford.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the next episode of Canines Talking Sense. I'm your host, Cameron Ford, and today we have a great guest on. Her and I have been collaborating and talking over the past few months. I thought it'd be a great opportunity to bring on Robin, and I'm going to let you pronounce your last name so I don't screw it up, but Robin
Grubel.
There you go. Okay. Robin Grubel to the show. Robin, thank you so much for coming, you know, spending time to come on the show. And I'll let you, I always try to let my guests do, you know, explain, you know, how you got in the canine world, what you do now. And then we're just going to have a fun conversation from there.
Okay, perfect. Thank you, Cameron, so much for having me on. Like Cameron said, my name is Robin Grubel. I am the CEO of the Canine Census Foundation, which is based out of Iowa. And we are focused on coaching the human end of the leash. So we work with doing a lot of coaching with handlers and trainers. I actually came to the odor detection dog world because of a sable-colored border collie that I ended up buying about 20 years ago and thought that it would be a fantastic idea to take this border collie and do search and rescue work and agility work and maybe a few other things because, you know, I was going to clone myself to do this, right? And I was lucky enough to find a team to start training. I trained horses growing up and had never really trained a dog and was lucky enough to stumble across a Steve White seminar probably my second year or first year into training. I believe Talon was only about 10 months old. And Steve became an epiphany trainer for me on behavior and timing and all sorts of things. So trained Talon up, we did live find and cadaver search and rescue work. Then evolved into FEMA level work, certified Moses in live find area search, as well as FEMA disaster live find work. I've certified several other dogs in FEMA cadaver work and also in wilderness cadaver work. And this was all while working a full-time job in corporate America. Yeah.
And I've seen that's it's kind of because a lot of the search and rescue organizations, many of those involved are volunteers. So there are people like you that have full-time career with lots of hours of its own, then devoting enormous amounts of your additional time to, you know, be in this craft.
Yeah, absolutely. So what and even the search and rescue world in general is populated by 99% volunteers. Mm-hmm. And so as a canine handler in the volunteer world, I am responsible for all the care, training, maintenance, and certification of my dog.
Yeah.
And so, you know, when I go on vacation, all of my vacation time was always fucked up and traveling to training.
Sure.
And I think about those days fondly now because I now work for myself.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's now you live, eat, and breathe whatever you're doing, right?
Yep. Oh, and, yes. Very
and
much so.
So, you know, I remember I've also missed lots of family holidays.
Yeah.
And things, you know, people tend to go missing when 4th of July. I've
yeah.
spent many 4th of July out in the middle of a field.
Mm-hmm.
And there's also the 2 a.m. phone calls because that's when, you know, law enforcement calls you because they didn't get the call until it started getting dark.
Yep.
And people then get scared.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's been really interesting. And since, you know, I'm now on, Nico, who is my latest, he's a Dutch Shepherd.
Mm-hmm.
And, we are hopefully going to be certifying in FEMA level cadaver work as soon as we're back up to quote unquote normal
yeah.
testing schedules.
Outside of
right?
the COVID schedules. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So working on that and ran into someone not too long ago that said, hey, I'm picking up some private work. So do you have some dogs you want to do explosives and narcotics with?
Okay.
And so have now certified dogs in both narcotics and explosives.
So yeah, you got your hands full there. But what's cool is you're able to relate to the various type of genres of detection that are out there. And, you know, and like you said, one of the important things that we don't spend enough time on is the education of the human. You know, we always do lots and lots of focus on the dog and how good the dogs are and this, that, and the other. And there's this big gap that exists for us as handlers or trainers. And not enough training companies or organizations or agencies devote what we now know is a identifiable problem, which is to educate us, to make us better at our skill or to understand. And as people have probably seen on social media and on the podcast and different things, I've been more frequently asking about documentation. And the reason behind that is so people understand what are they writing down, so that way then later they can take that information, apply it to their training, so that way their training becomes efficient. They know what they should work on. They know what gaps exist, or they know what they're proficient at, as well as being able to then take that information they wrote down and articulate it to those that ask questions, i.e. the legal system, or maybe even just another organization or entity that wants to utilize you or wants more information about why they should use dogs. But if we just arbitrarily just write down good stuff and we're happy with our dogs, we did some fun stuff, it shows that
dog worked well today.
Yeah, exactly.
Very excited on how everything went.
Yeah.
Because unless you track it, you're not going to change it. And you don't have the appropriate data. And it's been really interesting for me as even as I have evolved as a trainer to really understand the components of how to actually track the specific behaviors that my dogs are doing when I'm training them to do the silly little game of detection that we want them to do. And so I can formulate my next training plans based on what just happened. And you know, being able to count is highly important when you're talking about things like latency. So yes.
And training isn't and shouldn't be about just putting out odor and running your dog.
No.
Training should have a plan. And yes. We need to know what the objective is. If we're going out to do training without any objective or without a plan of action, what we want to accomplish in that training session, we're just doing arbitrary bullshit at the end of the day. We're not doing really any progression, and we're just checking boxes versus doing things that increase our reliability, increase our credibility in the dogs. And then again, the focus has always been about the dogs. What about a training session where we focus on our knowledge? You know, go do a search, and then I want you to report back to me and give me the information of what occurred. Or even before we search, I want you to tell me what you're going to do, how you're going to do it, and what your course of action is. You know,
so many of my students really hate it when I do this to them. Mm-hmm. Because I ask them, I'm like, before you get your dog out of the car, what are you wanting to accomplish with this training on, and why did you set up your problem this way? And so we go this whole entire conversation. Mm-hmm. And then I'm like, what behavior do you want your dog to do?
Yep.
And they tell me, mm-hmm. and then I ask them, are you going to pay me $100 if the dog doesn't do it? and then they're like, maybe. I'm like, okay, well, let's adjust what you're going to do.
Mm-hmm.
And then if your dog doesn't do this, what's your contingency plan?
Yeah.
Because often, you know, we put out an aid and, well, let's see what the dogs do. So we tend to operate in a testing mode for the dog,
yep.
instead of a true training and teaching mode.
Correct. Correct. I did a podcast with Sonia, and we were talking about Steve Stoops. And one of the things that I always heard him say was teach, train, test. But how often, you know, yes. so often though, everybody just wants to teach, test, and they don't do
yep.
hardly any training. They skip the middle part and go right to testing, and then they wonder why there's a problem, or they wonder
it
why,
all
and then
apart.
Then they get all upset because the testing failed, because the training didn't really exist or didn't get done properly. So then now the handler's upset, and if they had just followed the proper process of teaching, taking the required time for that, that way the animal understands what you're doing, and then training it, creating proficiency, and then testing it to see its reliability. And
right.
But we want to rush. We want to get done so fast, and I want to have my dog
Right. And even the training to proficiency, you know, sometimes I look at it, proficiency is good, but let's see if we can train to fluency.
Absolutely.
Which 100%. Is better.
Yeah, 100%.
Right.
Yeah.
And so one of the things I started working with students, I'm like, good enough is actually the enemy of great training.
Absolutely.
And so
no, I like that. Fluency is the right word to use. Correct. For sure.
Right. And so I spend a lot of time in my commitment to odor and train final response class, actually asking the students to define their trained final response behavior.
Yeah.
And because even, you know, I'm a professional certified coach. So one of the things that we actually ask people a lot to do, define where you're going, because unless you know where you're going, you're never going to get there.
Yep.
And so even as a trained final response with the dog, you know, what's your dog's trained final response? Well, it sits and stares at odor.
Mm-hmm.
Well, upon locating odor, how fast does it sit?
Mm-hmm.
How long will it sit?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and all of these different things.
Yeah.
And unless the handler or the trainer actually defines it and writes it down,
yep.
that you have scope creep.
Yeah.
So all of my trained final responses are actually written in my training log.
Yeah.
So every time I open up my training log, they're right there. This is the criteria.
Yeah.
For my dog.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And in that way, you know, and like we've talked about in these other podcasts I've had, is if you don't write it down, it didn't happen, you know, or it didn't exist, or people aren't going to assume. And in, unfortunately, right, wrong, or indifferent, this day and age, what you say isn't going to be valued as much as what you document over and over again, like you said, throughout
right.
time, not just what you get called on and questioned, let's say, while you're on the stand or while you're in a group of people, you know. No, it needs to be demonstrated and documented to show this is what happens when this condition or XYZ occurs. This is what my dog will do. And
right.
You know, you can't just wing that.
No.
And that's why we get a lot of handlers going, I have interest. My dog has interest. Okay, what's that?
That's wiggle language.
Yeah, exactly. So it's the catch-all to justify anything my dog does. That's what I want to do.
Right.
I don't want to be wrong, so I'm just going to say my dog has interest. So
right, and one of the hardest things, you know, is it's interesting when you talk about jumping worlds, because I've started really thinking about, you know, training a dog to do live find search and rescue work. Mm-hmm. If my dog and I don't do my job, some people die. Mm-hmm. Which kind of falls into the whole realm of explosive work.
True.
And, you know, cadaver work and narcotics work is also important.
Yep.
But there may not be immediate death ramifications for
Correct.
Some of it.
Yep.
So, and not to discount narcotics and
no, it's just a different, there's
right.
a different
it's,
consequence.
It's, right. And so it is actually very, very stressful in any of those situations to call an area blank.
Yeah.
And I know you and I have been having the discussion, and I was just out on some actual active searches. 98% of my searching with my search dogs are blank areas.
Yeah. No, and then, that was that you saw that survey, obviously, I put up and since, since I know this will air after I've already done this, I'll speak about the results. So, obviously the first question of that survey was what genre detection were you? NARC, explosive, HRD, SAR, bed
right.
bug, arson, other, whatever. So the, you know, next question was how often in training, this is of course a certified dog team. They're done with training. They are
right.
certified. They're operational. So how often in your routine maintenance training should odor be placed out? And I did the categories of 100% of the time to 80%,
right.
you know, 50 to 75 and so forth down to basically 10%. And then the next question was, in reality, when you deploy your dog on actual searches, how often do you find the target material that your dog is trained to detect? So of course the breakdown kind of went as follows. NARC handlers typically said, training should have odor out around 80% of the time. Their real world find ratio was between 80 to 90% of the time. So, and in that,
oh, they're lucky.
Yeah. Well, and in that though, I challenge those and say, why not have your training be far less? Again, your dog knows odor. So you don't
right.
need to have odor out all the time. It only
right.
strengthens your argument that your dog is, when a dog indicates on a real search that narcotic odor is present, because in training, your dog continuously and more often than not does searches that yield no odor and correctly
right.
demonstrates to you no odor is present. So on those searches that you're doing, where you, in real world searches where you're making finds, it validates that your dog is correct versus
right.
having your training constantly have odor. Because then if I look at those numbers, every time your dog gets out and does a search, it finds something. So how do I know your dog's just not offering you indications, you know?
And it's the example of true stimulus control. If under true stimulus control, when the stimuli is present, the dog offers the trained final response. If
yeah.
the stimuli isn't present, the dog doesn't.
Yeah, correct. And that's what we're looking for.
Right.
So then the
right.
moving to the next category was explosive dogs. And the average answer for explosive dog teams was 75% out in training should have odor out, but real world was 10% or less. And I figured the 10% was because we have, of course, deployed teams that were probably answering the question from around the world, or those that had worked dogs in a combat environment or military environment or contractor environment where they did have finds. And then here's the unique one. This comes from your world. The HRD side said training as a group, and again, and this was a pretty good split. I mean, there was about the same number of handlers until we get further down the line for each group. HRD had the same number of handlers responding as explosive, and NARC had a little bit more than everybody else. But so the HRD answer was this: training has odor out at least 80% of the time. However, reality searches, when they deploy their dogs for real, was under 10% of the time they had finds. So significant difference, which tells us what automatically will tell you that handlers are going to be ill-prepared to understand when their dog doesn't have odor on a training search, which means they're not going to be as confident, let's say, when they're doing that real search and saying there's nothing here. Because if 80% of your searches have odor in it, I'm going to, you know, and I've seen it firsthand myself, you struggle on a blank search because you don't expose yourself to it enough. But yet in the real world, you aren't finding anything much greater than 10% of the time.
And also think about the expectations.
Oh, absolutely.
That you're setting for your dog.
Absolutely.
And, you know, we often talk about, okay, you have to build enough resilience in the dog so that they can go out and search. You know, when we're in the search and rescue world, you know, I'm out actively working with my dog for anywhere from 20 minutes. A live find area search test type one is a 4-hour search with two subjects in 160 acres.
Yeah.
So, you know, we can be out there for the full 4 hours.
Yeah.
And, but you're creating that expectation in that dog of nose time. Yeah. We've been out here for 5 minutes. I'm supposed to run into odor. So let me offer this and see what it gets me.
I'm frustrated. Why haven't I found anything yet? Well, this smells interesting. Ooh, I smelled this. You reacted. Okay. Right. I know what
you
that reaction
came
means.
Over to check and see what I was looking at, which in actuality means you're acknowledging that this is correct.
Yep. Absolutely. You are giving the typical behaviors that are indicative to when rewards coming next.
Correct.
Yep.
Which is a conditioned stimuli.
Yep. So
just
this
like
is
your click.
Exactly. which is again, by, and people get, you know, sometimes riled up when I ask these questions, but the data that people are providing does match what individuals like us see when we go out and work with these teams or when we ask these questions in person. So it's not like this data is highly flawed. What it shows is, despite some of the spectrum out there and maybe certain things not lining up exactly, but overall, despite the static or the noise, what we see is if your dog is certified and you are actively out there and you do real world searches, you need to make sure that you are mimicking your real world environment, or in other cases, you're validating through your training that when your dog operates in the real world environment, it's accurate as possible, in the sense as we know there's no perfect dog, we know there's no perfect handler, but are you in the realm of that reliability standard with that tool, the dog? Which brings me now to the conversation of the American Association of Forensic Science and your part in that, and what the goal is of AAFS. And because, of course, you know, we've all heard, we've both been in the dog world long enough, oh, you're never going to get anybody on the same page. Everybody's going to argue. And like I've been telling people about what's going on is, this isn't about making people do anything. What this is going to do, though, is create a practice, a defined standard, in a sense. I'm using the word standard in a way loosely, but a guideline of, hey, this is what you should be doing. A best practices or better practices type of model.
Correct.
And whether or not your canine association follows this, or whether or not you think it's bullshit or not, or whatever your opinion is. But what's going to happen is you're going to have other legal aspects or legal entities look at this now because it exists and say, why this is what the industry experts mention are practices that should
industry
be implemented
standard.
And followed. Yes.
Yes.
Why don't you do this? Oh, I certify under, you know, ABCD organization. So we do this and we're good enough. And it's worked for 35 years and we've only been challenged so many times and da, 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 da. Okay, that's fine. But now you do have a national organization based in forensic sciences, not just a organization with a bunch of friends that all get together every year and party and drink and do certifications and right. slap each other on the back. And it's five cars, two fines, and five rooms, two fines, and all that. Now we have a more critical eye that is looking to say, are we really reliable? And it's not hard, but of course we as an industry fear change. And
right.
but you know, I'll step off my soapbox for a second, and I'll let you explain what it is, why it exists, and what the kind of the purpose and goals are.
Right. So I sit on the American Academy of Forensic Sciences Dogs and Sensors Committee. And there is a group of us. And when I say us, I mean us as in there's other cadaver dog handlers.
Yeah, it is a true mixture of professional, science, and academics all working together with a common goal.
Right. It's not just, and because the way the academy has put it together, they have this broad-based sprinkling of people from across disciplines.
Yep.
So that there is actually continuity mm-hmm. between explosives, narcotics, HRD, mm-hmm. bed bugs. I mean, we're arson, the whole yep. gambit of detection dog stuff
yep.
that's going on. And what happens is we actually have even working groups in each one of those disciplines. So I'll use the arson working group, for example.
Sure.
I think they've established it. I don't know. I just picked it up because it was the last one I remember talking about.
Okay.
And they actually have people who work arson detection dogs develop the standard
yep.
that they're putting forth. And if you go out to the AAFS website, you will that there we have some that are already out for general comment, which I encourage Correct. Everybody to go out there and read it. It's for pre-scented canines
yep.
And some trailing dog stuff. So I encourage people to go out and look
give
at
your
comment,
feedback.
Make comments.
Yeah, yes. Make your argument now because you don't have the right to bitch about it later on when
exactly.
it's out there. When And I know you guys, and you guys know I post it constantly whenever I see you guys
right.
make it out for public comment. So all those that want to have that critical eye and sharpshoot it from the sidelines and all that kind of stuff and say, in all your 30 or 40 years, you never needed this bullcrap.
Right.
This is so stupid. I don't need a bunch of lab coats telling me what to do.
Right. And it's a speak now or forever hold your peace
Correct.
Type of thing.
Yeah.
And because what happens is as you submit those comments, it comes into it comes back into us. Then it goes through a whole resolution process.
Yep.
And, you know, okay, is it somebody who just really hates how this was worded?
Yeah.
Or no, do they have a valid point? Let's rewrite this piece.
Oh, yeah.
And, yeah, so it goes through a whole bunch of stuff. And in order for us as a dogs and sensors group to put anything out or send it up to, I believe it's OSAC, so that they can yeah. approve it and goes into it's not the Federal Register. I think it goes to ANSI or something.
Mm-hmm.
It's got to be full consensus.
Correct. And what I like about it was, what you're bringing up is, It does get challenged a lot. This isn't just rubber stamp a bunch of scientists or academics wanting to tell, you know, professionals what they should do. This is professionals on these associations, on the boards too. And the professionals are there to basically, you know, explain and or debate why we have done it this way or what there's a problem with maybe legislatively or that you might face in litigation if you say it this way or
Correct.
Yeah, you guys get the concept, but you haven't been a handler. So you don't understand why we do this. So this is there,
right.
this component exists. So you may not in your own little tribe in your world, in this part of the country been a part of this, but don't worry. There are those just like you that are on there giving that voice. But with that said, the power of social media, the power of internet, you have a voice, and when these different things go out for public comment, you can say exactly what you want. Don't wait, like right. you said, don't forever now or you know, speak now or forever hold your peace, because
right.
you don't have the right to bitch about it later if you aren't taking an active role now to actually read what the statement says and then give viable feedback as to why you disagree. Or maybe if you do agree, you could also say, damn right, spot on. This is exactly what we need to have happen.
Right. And here's the other thing I will tell you. You know what? We live in a negative reinforcement environment.
Yeah.
So just in general, people don't. So if you think we're doing something fantastic or some just in general, be nice.
Yeah. Yeah.
And
no.
say, oh, my gosh, this is fantastic. So, yep. Total little segue here. Did
sure.
you know on average that because if for those of you that have kids, on average, a second grade teacher doles out 7 pieces of positive reinforcement for kids in second grade.
Okay. Yep.
In third grade, it goes to 0.
Wow. Yeah.
So that's probably a little old. That comes from my previous life of doing academic relations for large institutions. So that's my give out positive reinforcement. It feels weird, but in the grand scheme of things, with practice, it will get easier.
Well, plus it makes it more clear as to what is going the right direction. If we only hammer the wrong stuff, but we also, as any organization or any, you know, governing body,
animal.
Yes, they need to know what is the right way or what parts are right
yes.
and keep going that direction. But I think the other important component that has been to me the game changer is the dog being finally listed as a sensor, because that's huge legally.
Yes.
So I'll let you explain about how that came about or what was, you know, how did we get here?
You know, so I believe everybody remembers all of the Swigs.
Yep, Swig dog.
So
yep.
we had Swig dog. So at some point in the past, all of the Swigs were closed down.
Yep.
And what the Dogs and Sensors Committee has picked up is where the Swig dog left off.
Yeah. They kind of refined it. They took and again, this was that evolution. Because
right.
there was plenty of bitching and moaning about Swig dog and this, that, and the other. And it, like you said, it kind of died off, but it was never, its purpose was never to become a guidance system. It was the purpose initially was to create the conversation to get to where we're at now. So,
right. And we're going to go through an iterative process
yeah.
of, you know, we as an entity, as an industry are continuing to change
yep.
and evolve and get better. And it's been really interesting for me to come into the detection. And, you know, when I say detection dog world, I think of the more formal detection dog mm-hmm. world of arson, explosives, narcotics,
yeah.
Contraband, that type of thing. Because in the search and rescue world, all of it's self-study.
Yeah.
We don't have a school. I have, you know, all of my education was done as self-study, or, you know, the most formal education I had was going through some of the chicken workshops
yeah.
with Parveen Farhoodi and Bob Bailey.
Okay.
And, you know, working with Parveen for 3 months, side by side on some of the dog training and offering some chicken workshops.
Mm-hmm.
And that in and of itself was a whole behavior education that most handlers don't get. And being able to sit down with somebody who has had, like you, Cameron, who's had their hands on and looked at hundreds, if not thousands of dogs.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And being able to watch all of that and be like, okay, no, I'm sorry, Mr. Handler.
Yeah.
But you need to do this because your dog is doing this because your dog is doing Y because you're doing X. And so it's because, and I tell a lot of handlers, if you want to change your dog's behavior, you have to change your behavior first.
Canines Talking Sense webinars. You have heard from many of our guests. Well, now many of them are offering numerous webinars through our webinar platform on the Forward Canine website. All webinars can be purchased for $25 each, or you can join the Forward Canine Club channel and get 2 webinars a month for $25. Forward Canine Club channel always has 1 new webinar as well as 1 of the episodes from the past so you can enjoy again. Go to www.forwardcanine.com/webinar. Are you looking to become a trainer in sport detection? Forward Canine now offers the CSDT, Certified Sport Detection Dog Trainer, Level 1 and 2. Each course is a 1-week immersive course to help you in learning sport dog scent detection. No matter what sport program you choose, our class can help you and your future students have fun and enjoy the world of canine scent detection sports. Not only do we help you learn the training aspect for dogs and handlers, but we also cover import aspects to help you grow and market your current dog training business by now offering this new service of scent detection to your clients. For more information and to see upcoming classes for the rest of 2020, go to www.forwardcanine.com and click on the Courses tab. Show your support for Canines Talking Sense podcast and Detection Dog Pride. Go visit our new online store where we offer all kinds of hats, shirts, mugs, detection dog tools, and much more. Go to www.forwardcanine.com and click on the online store and get your new canine gear. Do not forget to check out our store often as we add new products every month.
And you're right, you know, many of us, and I've been told by this before by close friends, is, you know, sometimes as an instructor, certain things, because you've done it for so long, just become second nature to you.
Yeah.
And you miss some of those nuances to pass on. But then, you know, somebody, again, and I do, it happens to me more often when I'm with friends. You know, I may not get into the details of why I'm doing something. I just do it, and then you know, have them do something, and then they're like, "But yeah, I didn't do that because you didn't explain that part." And I'm like, oh, "Okay, I got you." Because to me, it was second nature. I just assumed that you caught that.
I forgot to twist my toe in this direction.
Yeah, and
sorry.
And then you know, the important part is, but you know, when I'm teaching, I think of those things because I know my audience, you know, is newer or what have you. But you know, kind of bringing us, you know, back to why these standards exist is to do that, to give us some uniformity, to give the industry a reference point of important things, all the way from
right. How
we store the odor, why there's certain storage practices for certain substances or chemicals, why we have to document things a certain way, why an evaluation is important in phases. It just isn't about, like I was making my joke a minute ago, having 5 cars out, 2 fines, and 5 rooms, 2 fines, that kind of thing. It's about doing an odor recognition test. Okay, good. Now we know the dog knows odor. Boom. Let's go to operational. Well, I'm not going to evaluate a explosive detection dog team in the same way or same manner as a narcotics team. And let's put it out even further. It's not fair to evaluate a explosive dog whose job is mass pedestrian screening or vapor wake and all the whatever the, you know, various terminology now is, depending on who you work for.
Air scent with explosives.
Exactly. You can't put those people in the same oversight or review process as your traditional explosive dogs team.
No.
So there now needs to be a split. And then, you know, Paul Martin and I were talking on the podcast together. You know, there's even in the HRD, the conversation is happening where there needs to be specialized HRD teams, maybe teams that are just specialized in blood. There's ones in dry, you know, in the very aged bone. Archaeological data, you know, canines versus the, you know, crime scene version.
Because if you think about, you know, what we're asking our dogs to do in the cadaver dog world. Mm-hmm. And it somewhat does relate over to narcotics because, you know, you're talking about, is my threshold, Will my dog alert on a single joint?
Yep.
For those of us who live in states that marijuana is not legal.
It's still not legal anymore, but
Right. And all the way up to a cargo truck full of marijuana is the same as, will my dog alert on a blood smear on a wall that has been wiped clean all the way up to a full body? And, you know, is the same dog the right tool for that job? And then you get into the whole, well, then, okay, do I have to train and maintain three different levels of cadaver dogs?
It's a conversation that has to, you know, and I brought up on that podcast was, you know, if you look at our counterparts in Europe, they are specializing. They're not generalist canine teams. You know, they take it and become a master
expert.
At that specificity of whatever that detection is, versus going, oh, I'm HRD. What does that include? Oh, I can go search 40 acres looking for, you know, a person that's probably passed away.
A whole body.
Yeah. And then I'm going to go do a crime scene or go do an archaeological dig. No, it's so different. So different.
Right.
But the way the system here in the States has been set up is the generalist mentality of, oh, I'm going to do live find, cadaver, my dog is awesome, I might do explosives just for fun, you know. And then and then they wonder why they can't really understand what their dog's telling them, partly because the dog is just as confused at times, and then the handler, because they do so many different things because it's their personal goal. Because last time I checked, I don't think your dog wanted or needed to do all those things, but you wanted to wear the cool t-shirt and have the cool stickers on your car and whatever else that motivated you. And the motto, I hear, you know, a lot of the ladies who started Nosework said, you know, on the podcast with them was, just because we can doesn't mean we should, you know?
Right.
And we have to remember that. Yeah, just because we can doesn't mean we should. And if your goal is to be a productive detection dog handler for whatever thing you're working on, be the best at that skill. Don't try to do everything, because you're not going to do all the things great, but you can do one thing really good. And if you try to generalize, you're going to have problems. It's the same thing in the sport world. You know, the sport world, you know, there's some great dogs out there, but then they also go do agility. Then they also go do barn hunt, and they also go do this.
Right.
And then they wonder why that dog sometimes has ranging problems. Like, the dog won't search more than a couple of feet from them without looking to them, because in all the other disciplines that they do, there's a ton of human interaction. And all of a sudden now in this one, you don't interact with me because you don't know the answer. So there's nothing you can do.
Right.
So now the dog, you know, contextually knows there's something different, but through, hey, you've done 3 years of agility and now you're only in your first year of nose work. And you're wondering why there's some struggles going on. Well, you know, you can't do everything. And there's going to be things naturally, just like us humans, we are skilled at. You know, I'm not going to be an NBA player. I promise you that. So no matter how tall I am, it's not going to make me, and I'm taller than average, so I'm not going to be a great basketball player. That's not how I'm built, and it's not how I have any skill. So, and our dogs are beautiful, amazing creatures that can do a lot of things, but not every dog can do everything.
Right. But it's been really interesting for me, some of the skill sets that you have by practicing basketball.
Sure.
Can come over and relate to your canine work, because you got to do footwork, right?
Sure.
But the interesting thing that has, you know, I've started looking at, why I really, really started thinking about training the trainer and coaching the trainer, is because I look at my history of my canine life. Mm-hmm. You know, I've trained upwards of 10 to 12 different dogs, certified at least 7 of them.
Okay.
And how many other people in the search world, yourself, a lot of the other detection dog handlers, actually have trained and deployed with multiple different dogs?
Yes.
And the our actual, everybody's always first tendency is to buy a better dog,
mm-hmm.
train a better dog, mm-hmm. Wash the dog and get a new dog.
Yeah.
But I always look at it as, well, if we take the time and train the trainers.
I was going to steer the conversation. I'm loving that you're taking it this way, because that was as I wanted to go, was talk about us humans. What are the things that you, as an instructor that teach people, what do we need? What are we weak at? But what are we good at too?
We're good at really, really wanting our dogs to succeed.
Yeah.
And we are, as canine handlers, and we are really, really good at having the general welfare of humankind, because narcotics, explosives, arson, we want to catch the bad guy.
Yeah.
Search and rescue, we want to bring them home.
Yeah.
Bed bugs, we want to keep people safe.
Yeah.
That's what canine handlers want to do.
Mm-hmm.
And we look at the opportunity to look at another sentient being who has totally different motivations, mm-hmm. who doesn't speak our language, and it's cool to train them to do this life and death job for a $15 toy.
Sure. Yep.
Because it's awesome.
Mm-hmm.
And so that just, and I have never met a more caring, sometimes cutthroat, but
yep.
caring,
yep.
said with all the love in my heart.
Yeah.
group of people that in general, we all agree on, we want to do good.
Yeah. Well, you said, we go into it with the right intention and the right goal. And
yes.
especially in that beginning stage with our dogs, that's where we excel. We excel at teaching them and reinforcing things because it's success-based. And then the wheels start
ego.
Coming off. Yeah, because we don't know how to move into that challenging and dealing with failure aspect that we can control and make us better.
Right.
But because of our fear of failure or our fear of mistake, and especially with peers around us watching us, we definitely don't
oh
want to
God.
Look bad. So then we avoid
right.
mistakes, and then that serves us no good. That serves us no purpose. We don't get
right.
better if we don't have mistakes or failures around our peers or around others with experience and understanding who can then help us. Because I constantly preach, I want you to fail in this. If you're going to fail, fail here.
Fail here.
And I'm gonna
right.
set up conditions that increase that probability. I'm not going to set you up to fail, but I'm going to set up situations that if you don't evolve or you don't challenge yourself, you might fail. But I want
right.
you to fail here, because then we can have a conversation about it and it's no harm, no foul, but you can get better. Or if you don't ever challenge yourself and then you get put in that real world search or situation, and then questions are asked or a failure is illuminated because after you did X, Y, and Z, somebody comes in and then finds, we find the error that occurred, then you're doing it in a very much more public or detrimental fashion versus having
right.
that problem worked out in training.
And it's really, really important. And, one of the things that I know we've talked about is creating a safe environment
mm-hmm.
for training that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And I love certifications. I have failed certifications
yeah.
and I have learned a lot by
yeah.
failing certifications. And I've actually had people tell me, because I'm a certifying official as well, and they're like, certifications make me nervous. I'm like, well, they should,
yeah.
but why? Well, because I might fail. Well, you know what? If all else fails, I know that I just paid somebody to set up a really, really good problem for me that I'm going to learn a lot.
Yeah.
And my entire job is to make sure my dog has fun.
Yeah.
So we're good. So what I see, if we're going back to, you know, so we can all agree that canine handlers, our hearts are in the right place. We want to do the right thing. If we really start talking about the tactical things that canine handlers I see universally, mm-hmm. we tend to lump behaviors instead of split them.
Yep.
And so if you really, really, really want to modify a dog's behavior or an animal's behavior, because guess what, people, this stuff also works on the humans in your life.
Absolutely.
don't expect, start reinforcing the exact like slice of behavior that you want. Mm-hmm. Don't wait for the animal to make a mistake. Stop them before they get there mm-hmm. and start over.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And if your animal does it wrong a couple of times, put the animal in the car and ask yourself what you did wrong as a trainer.
Sure.
Timing. Timing and training is a mechanical skill, and you can lose your ability to recognize and observe the behavior that you want unless you are always practicing.
Yeah.
So those are that and misuse of vocabulary, but that's like a whole nother podcast. But yeah. Anyway.
Yes, you are right. That is for sure a whole nother podcast because we are all over the place when it comes to, you know, terminology and things like that.
Well, and back to the Dogs and Sensors Committee, that's one of the things, that is one piece. There is actually a definitions document that has been approved. And we have a discussion almost, and we meet monthly for like 2 hours. And one of the discussions is that that piece is always a living document.
Yes, good.
Because the vocabulary will evolve as the profession evolves.
Yep. Because we're always learning. That's the whole important part is we can't be stagnant. We have to evolve as a industry. And
right.
we don't do things that we did 30 years ago. We actually do things, you know, better and more efficiently. But, you know, right. we also have to get over the fact of being fearful that, you know, of a change, you know, because we have that fear of change and, you know, it stops us.
Well, and
or our tribe, our tribal leader, our trainer in that area doesn't want to change. So then there's that issue too.
Right. And the, this is the way it's always worked, and looking at not training the dog in front of you.
Yeah.
Because the dog doesn't fit the method.
Yep. Yeah. And that's a big one because a lot of times, you know, people want to train that dog for that, the style that they like. So
right.
yeah, they, and again, it ends up getting a dog washed out. That's actually a pretty good dog. And
right. And if the dog would excel in a different job or even in that job, but trained with in a different fashion.
Yep. Yep.
So yeah.
So what we're talking about is our evolution of our industry with the help and collectively as a community coming together and saying, hey, look, we need to do better about this or have some more guidelines. We can't operate as loosely as we used to. We also just can't always go with whatever the handler said, and that's the Bible, and it always works.
Right.
We need to welcome some change as far as our challenges. We need to welcome the fact that if you think this works, okay, let's test it. You know,
right?
And you know, and do so in a way that removes, you know, critical bias that would affect an outcome, and that way. We have a better understanding of it. Does it really work? Yeah, it does. It's been tested and peer reviewed, and we know it works. Versus the
and we've taken data.
Correct.
We've actually tracked. You know, what are the important things for us to track and to know? And we can actually take data and have data sheets and logs that show that this works or this doesn't.
Yeah. So all very, very, very important aspects to help us. So in, you know, I'll, since you do, you know, work, have extensive work with the human remains aspect. What are some of the critical things or things that you see that are going to be the evolution in that realm?
I think, like we talked about a little bit, that the evolution of the cadaver dog handler, that we are no longer a generalist. Mm-hmm. That, you know, you might have a dog that does large remains versus the historical or prehistorical, and then all the way down to your trace dog.
Yeah.
One of the things that is also very the evolution from when I started to even now is the acquisition and use of training aids.
Yeah. Yep.
And, you know, it's been interesting for me. I have to actually purchase my training aids.
Okay.
But it's all highly documented.
Yep.
They're all tagged. It's like maintaining
evidence.
Evidence, yeah. Or a narcotics,
yep.
And explosives magazine.
Yep.
Yeah. And so, just like the narcotics and explosives, there is pseudo. You can also train on little aspects, but it's really, really important to be training on the actual odor that you're using.
Yes. And the various mixtures thereof, because it's
right.
Tough to, you know, and I come from an aspect in seeing the chemistry side of things that it's, you know, depending on our again, the genre of detection that we're working under, sometimes training on a very specific chemical and then creating the mixtures thereafter. And then right now I'm doing a firearms dog and we're looking at the premise of it being the other way around, train on the whole mixture, the scent picture mixture, and then maybe splitting off into other chemicals that may be present in most firearms, but may not be in all. But what we're seeing is training the firearm as a whole, that whole mixture is a much better option than trying to hone in on a specific chemical. So
training the vegetable stew.
Yeah. In that case, the cocktail is okay. Because
right.
Again, the real world version of it is, going to be the mixture of the solvents, the metal, the oil, the ammunition, you know, all these different things
right.
that exist. But there was an assumption in the gun dog world that, oh, you just train on smokes and black powder and you'll have a dog that finds guns. And as we learned, nope, that actually was not as accurate as we thought. And then those that were successful, it was more about the human odor that their dog was indicating to than it actually was the firearm. So
right.
the guys that do dual purpose and do human odor, they're successful. It's more of an article search for them. But as the industry has grown, especially out west with more laws and regulations going against the, you know, firearms or the ownership of firearms
right.
in certain aspects or, you know, where you can have it at, dogs being used specifically to go do searches for firearms, questions came up and what was reliable. So in that genre, there's been no actual research until now where Dr. Tiedemann from Texas Tech is doing it. And this is where I'm coming in helping her. I have my dog and I started him off on the entire firearm. And we did, you know, firearm fired was his first one that he learned, then firearm
right.
fired and cleaned. And then and this was all, you know, handgun. And then we went through the different manufacturers and then we did brand new, and every gun that's new still has been fired once. So we wanted to see how he did well there. So then we transitioned from handgun to then rifle, and then from rifle to shotgun.
Okay.
And we're progressing through all of these things and we're getting a very good indication. At the same time, the laboratory is testing the chemicals. What are the volatile chemicals coming off that
right.
can be singled out and then presented to a dog to see if it indicates it on it as a single? And this is gonna take some time, but what we have already seen so far is if your target item is that firearm, well, it's a mixture of all those things. Trying to
right.
find a single chemical to work from may not be as efficient as just teaching the dog, here's a scent picture. It's all these things, all of this in this conglomeration, and that's what you're looking for. But
right.
whereas an explosive, we might want to start off, or even narcotic, start off on this is the chemical you're looking for. Now this is the chemical you're looking for, even when it has this other odorant associated with it. So that way it understands, oh, I'm always looking for it no matter what it's scented with or what it's around it.
Right. I'm always looking for ammonium nitrate.
Correct.
In a certain threshold, because that's what is going to be important. Right.
Yeah. So again, so just back to the whole point of why the standard and the forensic committee exists is so that way we can make these adjustments versus just going, well, this is the way we've always done it. We're not going to change. It's worked great for us for 30, you know, I can hear every, you know, some of the mentors I have, I don't need to change. This has worked just fine for me for all these years. You know, I've been successful and you're right. But a lot of the challenges that exist today did not exist. The information that we have today did not exist. Right, wrong, or indifferent, it wasn't there. So now we have to progress. We have to, you know, look at things from a different point of view and be willing to accept these challenges and say, yep, we were right 30 years and we don't need to make these changes. Or, you know what, there's some evolution that needs to happen and we will get better. And what's cool is I've been seeing in the sport world is the sport world, obviously, because it's civilians that can adapt and make changes faster. You're getting to see that. And I've seen that a little bit in the search and rescue world, too, because as a volunteer or as a person who you're putting your own money into it, you're willing to look at some things and take information in and make adjustments faster than the bureaucracy side of things.
Well, and dog training and detection dog training, the world that we live in, is at the nexus of science and craft.
Yes. Great. Yep.
Right.
Yep. And Bob Bailey says it great too on that.
Right. And so, you know, and now, and that's just the behavior dog training side. And now we're actually having to take in the science part of odor detection and all of the different scents and odors that we have, and how the dogs are parsing and differentiating all of that. And then how do we make sure that they are truly aware and cognizant, or they are fluent in the behavior at the threshold we desire them to be?
Yep. No, it's so true.
Yeah. So our poor little canine handlers, we have a lot going on.
Yeah.
Because, you know, there's more to handling a dog than just getting the dog out of the car.
Yeah. No, there's critical thinking. There's what do you do when a monkey wrench is thrown at you in your situation? How do you properly explain what you're going to do? And how do you properly articulate what happened? You know?
Right.
And like you said, that's a lot of what you specialize in teaching, is the human aspect of being able to be proficient at those skills, as well as working their dog. But we also have to be good communicators about what we see, what we interpret, you know, how we utilized it, why we did it a certain way. We just didn't willy-nilly throw our dog out there and say, oh, this is what happened.
And, you know, almost every canine handler, I'm sure, has been in a position where their dog throws a couple of behaviors and somebody's standing behind them. You know, you've moved on to search your next section and somebody behind them is like, oh my God, we have to go search here.
Yeah.
And I'm like, no, you didn't.
Yeah.
Because I did not get this XYZ litany of behaviors that I expect out of my dog when we're actually on odor.
Yeah. So you bring up a great point. I almost forgot to ask this question. I see this happen a lot in the SAR HRD world, which is we run one dog, dog A does something, okay, go get dog B. And now we're going to run dog B. And dog B may not do what dog A does. So then then there's now a trust issue that's instantly developed. Maybe we get dog C and we do best 2 out of 3. Why is that more? Because obviously we don't do that in the drug world for sure. The bomb world, it shouldn't happen, but it happens occasionally. I've seen it more in the civilian aspect with private business or, you know, casinos may run a second dog just because, you know, you're talking shutting down major operations. They may want a second sniff on something. But even then, I don't advocate for that. But why is it, and what's your opinion on it as a practice within the SAR HRD world?
So that is common practice. And I think it has a lot to do with, oh, see, now you're catching me flat-footed because I'm like, oh, you know what? I've never had anybody ask me that question before.
Good. This is why we do the podcast.
Because this is how we were, and, you know, even in the female world,
yep,
that's actually part of our litany. Well, what I would do, my dog showing a focus bark alert at that's what they do. My recommendation is to bring in a second confirmation dog and bring in technical search,
yeah,
to see if they can find anything. Mm-hmm. And I think the answer becomes down to they are just dogs.
Yep.
And it comes into an effect of, I know when I go out right now, I have a 2.5-year-old dog, and one of the other dogs that we go work with is significantly experienced. Mm-hmm. And so she's seen a lot more in her training than my dog currently has.
And so my argument there is, well, then A, that's the dog that should be doing the work, you know,
correct,
because, and then B, then I have no problem using your dog, but let's get your dog to a better level, because if I use your dog and then I still have to go call that other dog over, I'm wasting efficiency and I'm wasting time. And the biggest thing I see from that side of the industry is this constant lack of trust for handlers and their dogs, because they've been through these situations numerous times, and then their dog does the opposite of whatever the other dog is. And
right,
then they have the rain cloud over their head for the next whatever training sessions or months or whatever, because this happened to them, or it's happened to them more than a few times. And
so
go ahead.
Here's as we're sitting here talking about this, and this is for me, right? So this,
yep,
is my,
your opinion,
my little gut thought, check,
yep. Yep.
My opinion. I call that second dog over just as a confirmation, because usually I'll call them over because my dog did something. Mm-hmm. I didn't get my full train final response, but I want to sleep tonight.
Mm-hmm.
And if I don't call that other dog over to, yeah, hopefully walk it,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know if I will be able to sleep because I may have missed it.
So, and I agree with the premise, but what do we,
right,
do now? If, what if we do now? Because how do we know really what the other dog may do? The condition may have changed by the time the other dog gets there. So let's say that dog walks it. Sure enough, turns out there was a person there. Your dog, even though it didn't give the full-on indication, was actually more accurate because of the time and the conditions at that moment were better than when the next dog finally got a chance to run it. Or B, the next dog runs it, gives a great indication, and we find nothing. So
right,
then now, so what I see is that, like you said, the intent behind the idea has some merit, but the result is so fraught with problems that,
right,
the juice isn't worth the squeeze, and that's my opinion, because I see so many more negative variables that come from this practice than really good positive ones.
Well, and here's the flip side of that, is I actually think one of the solutions to this particular problem, and your data shows it, is the increased number of blanks that,
yeah,
cadaver dog,
correct,
handlers are doing,
yes,
in their training.
It goes back to my whole point, is if you have a sound trained dog, trust what it tells you. You don't,
correct,
need to, if you're bringing another dog in, that means you trust that other dog potentially more than you trust yours. Because if you trusted yours, you'd call whatever that answer is. And I get it. If I'm picking on search and rescue at the moment, it's a volunteer force with a variable number of dogs used. This is why some of the practices,
right,
happen. But my thing is, regardless of your volunteer or not, you are a professional. Don't go out there and do,
right,
this stuff if you're not ready to be really doing it. This isn't for fun bullshit. This is real world stuff. If you're being called to potentially go save humans' lives, be on your game. Don't half-ass this.
And
don't just do it weekend warrior.
Right, and it also means that you train on your game all of the time.
Yeah.
Yep. And, you know, that is one of the things that has been interesting for me is, you know, going from being part-time, the weekend warrior type of thing, because I had a 9-to-5 job.
Yeah, no, and believe me, I find it highly admirable that people do this. So don't take it, you know, I don't want people taking it as I'm picking it. No. But what I'm getting at is if you are willing to invest your time and your effort to do that, be the best at it. And if you know your limitations, and if you're not ready, even though you got your certification, but you like you said a second ago, your gut check tells you, I may not be the best for this situation. Speak up. Say, hey, I don't want to do this at this moment because of whatever it is. Let's call another team over to go search that area.
And I will tell you, I was at one point when I was in between dogs, somebody called me, actually a couple people called me for searches. And I was like, I have a certified cadaver dog. Mm-hmm. I can't deploy her because I don't know what dog I'm getting out of the car.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I can recommend some other teams for you. Some, you know, and for those of us who are interested in the public good, right? That's really hard to do because you got to hang up your little superhero cape.
Sure. And it's tough because I get it. There's tons of hours that amazing people have put into this. And I think all of you guys that do this are amazing people for doing it. But I want you to also keep in mind, even though it's volunteer, you're still a professional required and expected to be a good tool to be used to help bring somebody home.
And the thing that is actually becoming much more salient is that as a cadaver dog handler, what you and your dog do can either put somebody in jail who doesn't belong there.
Yeah, there's that whole aspect, yeah.
Or the bad guy gets away. And so
as evidence becomes inadmissible because you didn't handle yourself in some way as a professional or didn't do documentation the proper way or, you know, took the easy cert because it was a certificate you could obtain and, you know, you had that piece of paper and the unknowing agency who does it, like, and that was something me and Paul talked about too was the law enforcement side detectives who aren't canine people that are charged with maintaining a case and investigating it don't even know what to ask. So they just go along with what you guys tell them. And if your information is weak at best, but you don't want to say no, this is where I have my problem is no, you need to say no. If you have to guess and if your common answer during training when training is a test in a sense where I'm going to create something you don't know the answer to and you come back to me with your common answer is I saw interest here that I don't think you should be out there. You need to have a level of confidence where you can walk through most of your training searches and go nothing's here or my dog showed indication here. And if you can do that a majority of the time, I know there's no perfection, but if you can do that a majority of the time, then I think you're reliable. But if the majority of your time, your answers are, I saw interest here, then I do not think you're reliable. And therefore, you may taint a case or you may have a problem because I want to look at your records too. Show me where you're doing this.
Right.
Show me what you've done here.
And that comes from doing a lot of blanks and blind blanks.
Yeah, absolutely.
That you don't know whether or not anything is there.
Yep. You have to be willing to push yourself and you have to be willing to walk out and be wrong at times, back to our point earlier, of making mistakes here with your peers.
Right. And finding the important thing is too, is as instructors, is creating a safe environment for people to fail.
Absolutely.
And, you know, I know people who thrive in a gotcha environment,
yeah,
I am that's not one of them.
No, I don't want that. I want to support you when you make your mistake. I want to show you what you did right or what you did wrong, and I'm going to help you. My goal is to make you a better team, and I have to do that by challenging you. If I just put odors out, numerous odors out too. I mean, that's the other thing too, is I'm not going to just throw out tons of odor and just say, okay, good. Your dog search, you know, goes 3 minutes and makes a find.
Right.
No, that's not real. I'm going to challenge you. And I'll give a short example real quick on a local company I do training with. And the funny part was, so the payment for me now is I do their maintenance training, but my maintenance training is focused on operational stuff. So set up training and say, hey, search areas over there. Come back. Let me know when you got some. Let me know what you got when you're done. And one of the newer guys, you know, wants his hand held. Well, if we're paying money, you should be out there watching us. Why? You're certified, right? Well, yeah, what kind of, and I got this runaround answer. Are you certified? Because if your company puts you out there, are you doing a search? Well, yeah. Okay. So I'm not there on those searches. They're not paying me right now to do your hold your hand, let's put some odor out, watch your dog. No, that's what you have your other people to do. I'm here to set up a scenario for you, push you, and see how you do. And then I'll debrief you afterwards and say, you did this good, you did that wrong. And most times how I do a debrief is, give me two highs, give me two lows. Two things you did good, two things you did bad. And most times, in your description of the things that you did wrong, you're going to hit the same things I am. So I don't even have to really hammer you on it. You've already identified it. I'm just going to confirm, yes, you're right. That was something that you need to do better. And that pushes them, but it's uncomfortable. So that individual is uncomfortable because they want to be coached the entire time. And there's training for that. But what I'm there to do is to push you to that. If you're certified, means any day at any point in time, you could be called to go do something for real. I need to make sure that you're reliable to do that. And I have to ensure training is set up that pushes you into that comfortability, which means you're uncomfortable.
And that means it's really important, because one of the things that I've noticed is that people who train together all of the time, you develop habits.
Oh, yes.
And patterns.
Yes.
And it shows in your dog.
Oh, 100%.
Right. And so it's really, really important. And I, you know, one of the things that has been fantastic for me to start doing work with the explosives and narcotics, and I started training with some of the nose work people.
Yeah.
And, you know, the nose work people is like, oh, well, they tape odor to the underside of the table corner. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, why would you ever put odor there? Mm-hmm. But, you know, wouldn't you know, the narcotics certification that I did 2 weeks prior, they taped odor to the underside of a chair.
Uh-huh. Yep.
And I was just, you know, and I was like, oh my God. So then my cadaver dog handler brain goes, oh my God, there could be blood spatter on the underside of a chair.
Sure.
And so, but you know, we get into a pattern, and guess what?
Yep.
When you go do a search or a certification, you search to the pattern that you automatically know how to do.
Yep.
Creatures instead of walking. Right. And so that's why it's really, really important to find many different tribes to train with.
Absolutely. And get out of your comfort zone, because, you know, a lot of us are fearful to go train with that group that we don't normally train with because we don't want to look bad in front of them, or we don't want them to talk, you know, talk shit about us, you know, all this kind of stuff.
Right.
And you know what? Because that uncomfortable feeling is something that's going to happen to you for real. So put yourself into it, because guess what? That's a controlled setting. What's the worst? Oh, yeah, they're going to say something. Well, guess what? When they come to your training, same thing will happen to you or to them. I promise you that happens all the time.
And it, you know, and we as a community just need to concentrate on what's the common goal. The common goal is protecting people and bringing them home.
Yep. Absolutely.
And if we can, and you know, check your ego at the door.
Yeah. No. And,
it's hard.
Yeah. It's very hard. And you know, I get sometimes, you know, called out as a antagonist or a bad guy in the sense that I push like this, but you know, once people realize what I'm saying and why I'm pushing you that way is going to, at the end of the day, make you better. They get used to it. They're like, okay, I like that. But man, I don't like the fact that you pushed me in the pool in the deep end. I wasn't sure if I knew how to swim. I'm like, you'll be fine. You know, and I take a lot of that from coming from the law enforcement community, but especially coming from the Naval Special Warfare community with the SEAL teams, was the, once your foundation, once you knew what you were doing, it was as instructors, you're constantly pushing, you know, you're creating problems to create solutions, and it's not comfortable.
You have to, but that's how you create resiliency.
You got it. You learn how to problem solve.
Right. And, you know, and that is one of the things that ideally, if you worked with, you know, your dog, mm-hmm. having a resilient dog that can look at that and say, okay, well, that doesn't look like this, but it looks like this and we're okay.
Mm-hmm.
Is really important, but also having the human to understand that they can do the same thing. And what's been really interesting for me is coming from the search and rescue world, where 95% of my searching is off leash.
Yep.
To come into the explosives and narcotics world, where everybody works their dog on leash.
Yeah.
And I'm like, why are you guys making it so hard?
Yeah. Oh yeah.
And some of it has to do with, you know, the dual purpose dogs I get, right?
Mm-hmm.
To a certain extent. Because I've got a big pointy-eared Malinois Dutch Shepherd that, you know, I work him off leash a lot.
Yeah.
But I also, it's so much easier when you can stand back and watch the dog do its thing.
Oh, way easier. Way, way, way easier.
And I was at a seminar not too long ago where a whole group of law enforcement were using flexi leads.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And wouldn't you know, I hadn't brought mine with me. I went out and bought a flexi lead so I could start working my dog at a flexi lead. And I'm like, oh my God, this makes things much easier because I am not that coordinated.
Oh yeah, no. And there's another reason why I use a flexi leash for certain occasions and for certain aspects of training is because the dog is feeling constant resistance. So when the dog's got odor, they push harder because there's constantly this resistance on them versus always having the loose leash. And don't get me wrong, there's also reasons why I have a loose leash so that way I can also feel this. But there's reasons why sometimes I create adversity for the dog to get through, to get to odor, and then they realize it's a positive experience. So if there's constant this constant tension, and then all of a sudden when they got something, they really dig in, then I know. So then when I'm working a loose leash and they do that, it's almost like yanking the leash out of my hand kind of concept. So there's great, you know, I like having lots of tools. I don't like going, because there's going to be the advocates that say, oh, flexi leashes are horrible. And for certain parts of their argument, they're absolutely right. And then, so I'm for it, but there's each, you know, product has a design and a purpose that we can either modify and use for, you know, that's productive, or we can even by design use it to create a problem for someone to go through. So, you know, I don't like to, you know, create absolutes in one direction or another. But with all that said, the goal is ultimately to push ourselves to be better, especially when we are entrusted with these professional tasks of protection and or safety or recovery of people. So,
yes.
And
agreed.
I thank you so much for taking the time to do this interview. And I know you and I already talked, we're going to do, you know, webinar together. We're also, I'm gonna let you talk about this, but I know I'll be coming out to you.
Yes,
we're going to do seminar in person. But for our listeners, you can talk about that, but how do they get a hold of you and what things can you share with them?
Right. So the best way to get a hold of me is at CaninCensus, find me on Facebook, caninecensus.org. And just to give you an idea, census is, it's actually Latin.
Mm-hmm.
And because I'm all about teaching handlers and trainers to understand the perceptions that the dogs are the senses that your dogs are perceiving
uh-huh.
and responding to that.
Uh-huh.
So that's where the name came from. Nice. And I'm sure I mangled that in my graphic designer, my branding people are going to kill me later. But so caninesenses.org, we're on Facebook. I'm offering with some of the COVID stuff, we're doing more private coaching type of things. I do have handler quarters here at the facility. I've got 700 acres, wow. Three ponds, a handler's quarters for people to stay at.
Nice.
I am located in Southern Iowa, so there might be a little trek to get here, but it's sure. nice and beautiful.
Yep.
And can set up anything from cadaver to narcotics, explosives, arson work, the whole nine yards.
Perfect.
I know Cameron is, we're trying to find a day, and I haven't confirmed with him because I keep looking at all the COVID numbers going,
I know, right?
Oh my God.
We will have right? it. It has picked the right date, so that way we want people to be able to attend it for sure.
Right. It will either be this fall or next spring.
Yep.
Right?
Yep.
And so we will go from there. But I'm doing a workout weekend in August where you bring your dog, you bring whatever you want to have set up, and I spend the weekend with you and we set it up.
Perfect.
And one in August, one in October, and then I'm doing a train final response commitment to odor virtual class in October as well.
Awesome. Good deal.
Yep.
Good deal. And I will put your info on the show notes. So those that are listening to this,
perfect.
Just scroll down in the on the screen here, and you will see the content, the links to reach you. So
perfect.
Again, Robin, thank you so much for taking the time to come on here and allow us to have a fun and sometimes best word to use, not fiery debate,
vulnerable,
passionate. Oh, there you go, vulnerable and passionate conversation
on our
dogs and our industry. And so again, thank you for coming on, taking the time to do that.
Thank you so much, Cameron.
Yep. And everybody, as usual, you can always contact me at cameron@fordcanine.com. And everybody, thank you for listening to Canines Talking Sense, where it's okay to be nosy.